Another experience that many in the religious world like to claim as exclusively their own is the tranquility of meditation. Meditation is especially popular with the New Age movement. Meditation is to many in the New Age crowd what prayer is to the more traditional monotheistic crowd. What both share in common, however, is the notion that meditation and prayer both involve getting in touch with something outside of you. This something outside of you is a mysterious and incomprehensible something or other that practitioners variously label as the astral plane, or a field of pure potentiality, or Brahman. Some just call it God. Not surprisingly, meditation is often practiced in a mystical context. What I want to do here is briefly consider meditation in a very non-mystical, purely atheistic context. Specifically, I want to consider meditation in an evolutionary context. Human beings are the only animals that have evolved a capacity for sophisticated language. Language is a tool, literally a tool, that enables one human being to communicate understanding to other human beings. This is its great power. Language is a remarkable talent with almost magical qualities. Think about what takes place when we speak. I say the word cat, and a mental representation of a cat springs into your mind. I say the word dog, and a mental representation of a dog springs to mind. I say Eiffel Tower, or horseback riding, or Elvis, or September 11th, and with each of these words or phrases, a unique mental representation springs into your mind. It's almost like I'm painting a picture in your mind, with every word I speak being the mental equivalent of a stroke of the brush. It's really quite remarkable. Language enables us to share understanding with others, but language also enables us to build understanding internally. We do this by talking to ourselves, and we do this all the time. Even when we're all alone, there's this almost non-stop conversation going on in our heads. And as we talk to ourselves, we're caught up in a purely abstract world, a world that is often far removed from the world of the present moment. Have you ever found yourself driving your car somewhere, and when you arrive at your destination, you can barely remember the trip? That's kind of weird, don't you think? I mean, here you are driving this heavy and complicated piece of equipment, navigating your way through traffic. A wrong move here or there, and a certain catastrophe. Driving a car is a very complex activity that requires your careful and constant attention. Yet you can barely remember the trip you've just taken because the whole time you were arguing with Rush Limbaugh on the radio. It's almost like there's two people possessing your body at the same time. One person is soaring through the distant clouds of abstract thought. The other is grounded in the here and now of the present moment. These two people that possess your body are what I like to call your higher self and your lower self. Now, I need to be very clear that my version of a higher self is not the same thing as the typical New Age version of the higher self. Many in the New Age crowd view the higher self as some mystical part of you that exists in some higher and mysterious dimension of reality. My version of the higher self is much more familiar and down to earth. My version of the higher self is that conversation in your head. Your higher self is that part of you that's arguing with Rush Limbaugh. It's that part of you that thinks and plans and dreams and creates and talks. That's the higher self. Your lower self, on the other hand, is that part of you driving the car. Your lower self is that part of you that is in the present moment. Now, by calling it a lower self, I don't mean to imply that it's somehow less important than the higher self. Not at all. In fact, it's in the lower self that we enjoy our most intimate contact with reality. The importance of framing our discussion in the context of evolution is to remind us that despite our tremendous intellectual capacities, we human beings are still animals. We sometimes lose sight of this. As intellectual animals, we engage in behaviors that create an illusion that we are not animals. For example, we wear clothes, We use restrooms. We mate behind closed doors. We style our hair and shave and drive cars and write music and invent religions. And we have language. But underneath it all, we're still animals. Your lower self is that animal part of you. The goal of meditation, as I see it, is to experience your lower self undistracted by the higher self. Put another way, the goal of meditation is to experience your animal self. Now, experiencing your animal self does not mean casting aside your morals. It's not about running down the street naked and growling at people. It's simply about getting into the present moment. Specifically, it's about removing the distraction of the higher self so you can experience the present moment in all of its sensual richness. How do you get in touch with your lower self? Very simple. You have to remove the distraction of your higher self. How do you do that? You have to shut down that part of you that takes you away from the present moment. You have to shut down that conversation in your head. You have to stop talking. It's as simple as that. Actually, this is not simple. It's hard. Just try not talking in your mind, even for 30 seconds. If you're anything like me, you'll find this to be almost impossible. This internal conversation is a nearly involuntary mental activity. But with practice and patience, you can do it. And it's worth the effort because meditation can be a profoundly useful experience. Meditation gives you a place that you can go inside yourself to get away from it all, a sort of mental escape. When you're in the present moment, you aren't thinking about that IRS audit, or the deal that fell through at work, or that argument you had with your girlfriend, or your impending death. You're thinking about none of this. In fact, you aren't thinking about anything at all. You are simply in the present moment, like an animal. The common denominator in all meditative experiences is the shutting down of that conversation in your head. Some people call this quieting the mind. Using the quiet mind as our standard, we can see that meditation can encompass a whole range of activities that we wouldn't typically associate with meditation. When we think of meditation, we too often imagine someone sitting still in a quiet place, eyes closed and mumbling a mantra. Now don't get me wrong here, it can be that too. But it needn't be restricted to that. For example, playing a sport can be a form of meditation. Have you ever watched a sporting event where an athlete is in what some people call a zone? When an athlete gets into one of these zones, it's like he can do no wrong. Now, the way athletes typically describe these zone experiences is quite revealing. They usually say something like, "Man, I don't know. I just got totally caught up in the moment. It was like I wasn't even thinking." Have you ever heard him describe it like that? Now, interestingly enough, statements like these are more accurate than you might think, because in a very real sense, the athlete isn't thinking. At least, the athlete's higher self isn't thinking. The higher self has essentially disappeared, and the lower self, the animal self, has taken control. Athletes also describe the experience as getting out of their own way. Now, who's getting out of the way of whom here? Very simply, it's the higher self getting out of the way of the lower self, the animal self. During episodes of peak performance, the athlete is totally absorbed in the present moment. His attention is consumed in the experience of being and doing. This can be a wondrous thing to behold, and an even more wondrous thing to experience. And it's all meditation. Many musicians know a similar experience. Musicians often speak of losing themselves in a great performance. This is meditation they're describing. Remember, in the evolutionary context that I'm advocating here, the common feature of all meditative experience is the shutting down of the higher self. When a world-class musician like Itzhak Perlman gives a riveting performance, he's not thinking about every single note or every little finger placement. Instead, he just loses himself in the music. He gets out of his own way, as the athlete says, and lets his animal self take over. Now, to be sure, the higher self does play an important role in music. It's the higher self that composes the music. It's the higher self that designs and builds musical instruments. But it takes an animal to put on a great performance. Spirituality is traditionally thought to be a function of one's relationship with God. I prefer to think of spirituality in the broader and more naturalistic context of one's relationship with reality. In this naturalistic context, peak performances in music and sports can be viewed as very spiritual experiences. Interestingly, peak performers often employ relationship language to describe the experience. For example, they sometimes describe the experience as being better than sex. Now, I don't know about that, but that they would describe the experience in this way is not surprising, because it is during these episodes of peak performance, these episodes of meditation, that we enjoy our most intimate moments with reality. And this is the case whether we're playing a sport, or performing music, or sitting quietly in a Buddhist temple, or for that matter, having great sex. The moral here is that you needn't sit motionless like a statue in order to enjoy the experience of meditation. You need only remove the distraction of the higher self, thus allowing the present moment to consume your full attention. There are two more experiences that I want to briefly touch on here. The first is a sensation that many people claim to experience during episodes of deep meditation. The sensation is often described as a feeling of connectedness or oneness with everything in the universe. Practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism often claim to experience a sensation of oneness. In a recently published book titled Why God Won't Go Away, medical doctors Andrew Newberg and Eugene D. Aquile set out to understand the biology underlying these oneness experiences. In their book, the authors describe an experiment they performed on 8 practitioners of Tibetan meditation. In the experiment, each participant would put himself into one of these deep meditative states, deep enough to experience this sensation of oneness with the universe. Once in this state, the meditator would signal the authors by tugging on a string attached to his finger. At this point, a radioactive material is injected into the meditator's body, and a SPECT scan is taken of his brain. The SPECT scans were performed to determine if specific areas of the brain could be associated with this experience of oneness. What the scans revealed was a sharp reduction of activity in a region of the brain that Newberg and D'Aquile dub the orientation association area. This part of the brain functions to, and I'm quoting from the book now, draw a sharp distinction between the individual and everything else, to sort out the you from the infinite not you that makes up the rest of the universe. End of quote. The authors believe that reducing activity in this part of the brain may very well be the biological dynamic underlying the sensation of oneness. And this just seems to make sense. Shut down that part of your brain that helps you know where your body leaves off and the rest of the universe begins, and the resulting sensation is naturally going to be one of blending in with the rest of the universe. You become one with the universe. Like all meditation, the oneness experience requires the individual to quiet his mind, to shut down that internal conversation. But the oneness experience requires an additional step. It requires the individual to sit still and quiet and with his eyes shut. Now, there's a reason for this. The orientation association area of the brain requires constant input from the senses in order to function at normal levels. When a meditator sits still and quiet and with his eyes closed, he is reducing the sensory input to his brain. If this reduction of sensory input persists long enough, the activity level of the orientation association area will eventually drop. And this, in turn, will produce the desired sensation of oneness. Now, it's important to point out that the authors performed their experiment on only 8 individuals. We cannot yet say with certainty that this particular hypothesis of the oneness experience is a scientific slam dunk. But I think their results do give us good reason to believe that the oneness experience is a result of a purely natural process. It's not a mystical, higher dimensional, out-of-body experience. Nobody's being whisked off into Never Never Land. The problem with viewing the oneness experience in a mystical context is that it creates in the minds of those who seek this experience all sorts of erroneous expectations. These erroneous expectations can actually hinder one's efforts to achieve the experience. If you approach the experience with the expectation that God is going to beam you up to the planet Kolob or something, you may never have the experience. And that's because you are expecting the experience to be something that it is not. Viewing the oneness experience as a natural experience makes it a more accessible experience. I want to say one last thing about this oneness experience. When a person is in the thick of this oneness experience, it is perhaps the closest he will ever get to feeling that sense of perfect security that we felt as infants. As intellectual beings aware of historic events like the Holocaust and September 11th, we are confronted with the fact that this world of ours is not perfectly safe. This awareness of the dangers and uncertainties of the real world is incompatible with perfect security. As a consequence, a feeling or sensation of perfect security can only be experienced in the absence of this intellectual awareness. By shutting down the higher self, we effectively turn down the volume on that part of us that tries to make sense of the world. In this state, we are keenly aware of sensations, but oblivious to ideas. We aren't thinking about death and taxes, just like infants don't think about death and taxes. There's a sort of temporary security in this intellectual oblivion. The security is an illusion, of course, but the sensation is real. Add to this sensation of security the sensation of being one with everything in the universe, and it's easy to see why many people describe the experience in religious terms. These sensations of security and oneness are the very experiences that many in the world of traditional religious belief so desperately long to feel. Ironically, these experiences are most readily accessible to those who understand them and approach them as the natural processes that they are. These experiences are most readily accessible to atheists. There's one more experience that I want to briefly touch on. It's what some people call the mystical experience. The expression mystical experience encompasses a variety of experiences, including sensations of religious ecstasy, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, visions and voices, and even a sense of divine presence. Again, from their book, Why God Won't Go Away, Newberg and D'Aquili refer to the work of Jeffrey Saver and John Rabin, two neurologists who have studied the connection between brain activity and these so-called mystical experiences. According to Saver and Rabin, the temporal lobes of the brain appear to play a key role in the production of these mystical experiences. For example, seizures in the temporal lobes have been associated with sensations of sudden ecstasy, religious awe, out-of-body experiences, and even the perceived presence of God. Now, this raises what I think is a rather profound possibility. If these mystical experiences really are the product of seizures in certain parts of the brain, then perhaps these parts of the brain can be stimulated artificially by some means other than a seizure. If we could figure out how to do that, then perhaps we could reproduce these experiences in the laboratory a sort of test tube God. Believe it or not, somebody has already done this. The guy's name is Michael Persinger, a neuropsychologist from Laurentian University in Toronto, Canada. Through a combination of sensory deprivation and the use of magnetic fields to stimulate the temporal lobes, Persinger has successfully reproduced mystical experiences in the laboratory. And when I say mystical experiences, I mean visions and voices, near-death experiences, even the felt presence of God. The experience consists of sitting in a sensory deprivation chamber and strapping on a special helmet designed to stimulate the temporal lobes. Once you're settled in, Persinger and his crew flip a few switches, and before you know it, you're having a mystical experience. On demand. I saw this contraption on TV one time. It's essentially a motorcycle helmet rigged up with a bunch of electrodes. Now, when I first saw someone wearing this thing, I couldn't help but peer into the future a bit. You know what's coming, don't you? It's inevitable. It's a portable version of this thing that you'll be able to pick up at any JCPenney's or Target. The Sony Godman. And then, of course, there'll be the upgrades, the Sony Godman 2 and 3. Or maybe they'll call it the God in the Box, or perhaps the Strap-on God. Who knows? You probably think I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. You mark my word, the day is coming, and is probably sooner than you think, when we will see these devices sold in stores to the general public. And when that day comes, just remember, you heard it here first.